The English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel performs air raids on the Gaza Strip for the fifth straight day, prompting Palestinian resistance groups to retaliate with rockets. Also in Palestine, Israeli troops raid a refugee camp in the West Bank, killing two Palestinians and injuring several more. Also in headlines, Rome stressing its all-out support for Kiev as Zelensky visits Italy and his first trip to the country since the conflict began in Ukraine. Hello and welcome to World News from our Tehran headquarters with me, Behruz Najafi. Beginning this news hour with the funeral procession being held on the Besij Gaza Strip for two Palestinian resistance commanders killed in Israeli raids. The two senior officials of the Islamic Jihad movement were martyred in airstrikes on Friday. Eight resistance commanders have been killed along with their family members since the Israeli warplanes began pounding Gaza on Tuesday. Israel has continued with its air raids for a fifth day, targeting different parts of Gaza City. In retaliation, Palestinian resistance groups have fired more rockets at Israeli settlements across the Gaza fence and the Israeli settlement of Ashkelon. Palestinians have fired nearly 1,100 missiles and rockets into Israel over the past 5 days. At least 33 people in Gaza have been killed and some 100 wounded in the attacks. Ashraf Shannon says that Palestinian resistance groups are pressing ahead with their retaliatory attacks against the Israeli regime.
Palestinian resistance have been firing rockets towards the occupied territories, targeting areas as far as Tel Aviv, Rehovot, as well as settlements near Al-Quds, Bethlehem, and also in the Negev, what we've seen over the last days, an increase in the military capabilities of Palestinian resistance, mainly Al-Quds Brigade's military wing, who yesterday released a video of their latest rocket called Burak 85 that reaches up to 85 kilometers. The Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile interception system. It's a multi-billion dollar system that was financed by the United States, has failed to intercept most of the rockets. Nearly 70% of the rockets that were fired from Gaza have managed to hit areas inside the Israeli regime. And the use of the Burak 85 rocket has forced Tel Aviv to use another system, a missile interception system called David Sling, that only managed to catch or down a few of those rockets.
In the meantime, the occupied West Bank has witnessed another day of Israeli bloodletting of Palestinians. Regime forces raided a refugee camp in Nablus, killing two people there. Several others were also injured. One of them is in critical condition. This amid Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip, as we just reported. Nablus has been the flashpoint of the violence in recent months. The regime has performed repeated raids on refugee camps there. The violence in the West Bank has claimed the lives of more than 100 Palestinians since the beginning of 2023. Now, our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us a short while ago with details regarding this Israeli raid.
It seems that Israeli undercover units, this means that Israeli forces described as Palestinians entered the refugee camp of Balata, the neighborhood of Al-Jasamin in Balata refugee camp. Then Israeli forces raided the refugee camp and surrounded a building there. They were demanding via loudspeakers Palestinians inside this building to turn themselves or that the Israeli forces would explode the house. Then clashes had been taking place between the residents and fighters inside the refugee camp of Balata with Israeli forces. In the last few days, Palestinian resistance groups, including the Jihad movement, Lion's Den and Jenin Brigade, issued statements saying that what's going on in Gaza and the airstrikes that are being taking place against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the increased number of martyrs, this means that Palestinians will continue their struggle here in the occupied West Bank.
Italy stressing its all-out support for Ukraine as President Volodymyr Zelensky arrives in Rome. And that's his first trip to Italy since the conflict began in Ukraine. Italian President Sergio Mattarella told his Ukrainian counterpart that Rome is ready to provide Kyiv with aid in terms of military, financial, humanitarian, and reconstruction in short and long term. Zelensky also met with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni before heading for the Vatican and meeting with Pope Francis. He will also travel to Germany as part of his tour of Europe. Zelensky is promoting a 10-point peace plan that calls for restoring Ukraine's territorial integrity, the withdrawal of Russian troops, and the cessation of hostilities. Now, Moscow says that Ukraine has used British long-range cruise missiles to target two industrial sites in the Russia-held city of Luhansk.
For this strike, Storm Shadow missiles were used that had been supplied to Kyiv regime by Great Britain despite London's declarations that they would not be used against civilian objects. As a result of the strike, the fire broke out at the chemical and food processing plants. Neighboring residential buildings were damaged as well. Civilians were hurt, among them six children. Russian air forces took down the Ukrainian Su-24 who carried out the strike as well as MiG-29 that covered it.
The defense ministry added that Russian forces have gained control over another block in the eastern city of Bakhmut. But a senior Ukrainian military commander says that Kyiv's forces are advancing along parts of the front line near Bakhmut. The Iranian Navy says it's conducting its first round-the-world mission aimed at promoting peace worldwide. Chief Commander of the Navy, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, said that the mission is performed by the 86th Navy Fleet, comprised of Dana destroyer and Macron forward base ship. He added the mission started in September 2022 from Iran's southern port city of Pandarabas. Admiral Irani said that the fleet is non-Iranian, noting that it has visited several countries, including India and Indonesia. Now, moving on, people in Turkey are set to cast their ballots in presidential and parliamentary elections tomorrow. The elections are a litmus test for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his ruling Justice and Development Party. 64 million people are eligible to elect 600 members of parliament and the next head of state. Around 2 million Turks living abroad already cast their ballots on April 17th. Incumbent Erdogan is among four candidates approved by the country's electoral body. According to opinion polls, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, leader of the main opposition, is another front-runner. Candidates held their final campaign rally on Friday to woo many of the 5 million first-time voters. A runoff is expected to 2 weeks later if none of the presidential candidates crosses the 50% threshold necessary to win the race. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has urged Congress to raise the nation's debt ceiling to ward off an economic crisis. She called on legislators to increase the $31.4 trillion federal debt limit to avert an unprecedented default that would trigger a domestic and a global economic downturn. Now, the comments were made. President Biden warned that the country could slip into recession if lawmakers fail to raise the debt ceiling.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urged Congress to raise the $31.4 trillion debt limit and avert an unprecedented default, saying that a failure to do so would have dire consequences. Yellen's comments come after she warned of an economic catastrophe if the U.S. fails to raise its debt ceiling in the coming weeks. She has also previously warned that the U.S. could fail to meet its debt obligations sooner than expected, and it may run out of measures as early as June 1. Yellen issued the latest in a series of increasingly stark warnings in remarks prepared for a press conference meeting in Japan with her counterparts from the group of seven G7 rich nations, as well as India, Indonesia, and Brazil. Yellen's comments came as a political stalemate over raising the debt limit was forcing the Treasury Department dangerously close to worst-case scenario, which is a potential U.S. debt default.
The notion of defaulting on our debt is something that would so badly undermine the U.S. and global economy that I think it should be regarded by everyone as unthinkable.
In order to avoid a default on the nation's debt, Congress must vote to either raise or suspend the debt limit before the Treasury runs out of emergency funding. But with only days left this month, time is running out to reach a deal. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. The last time this happened, the U.S. saw its credit rating downgraded and interest rates on its existing debt go up. Even if the nation avoids tumbling over the fiscal cliff, the U.S. economy could suffer.
They're doing to the best of my knowledge, what no other political party has done in the nation's history. They're literally, not figuratively, holding the economy hostage by threatening to default on our nation's debt that we've already incurred.
Now, Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. Now, if the limit is not raised by the June 1st deadline, the U.S. may default on its debt payments, which in turn could touch off a global economic catastrophe.
The debt ceiling is the maximum amount the U.S. government is legally authorized to borrow to meet its obligations. Many investors are bracing for the economic fallout of the deadline for the U.S. to raise the debt ceiling or default on its obligations. The U.S. government has run a deficit averaging nearly $1 trillion every year since the year 2001, meaning that it spends that much more money than it receives in taxes and other revenues.
Congress has told Treasury, you should pay our bills, you should pay our debt. But at the same time, it's told it, you can't borrow anymore to pay those bills and debt. And at the same time, Congress has authorized all the spending that's being done. So the spending's going out the door. The bills are showing up at Treasury, and Treasury isn't getting enough revenue from taxpayers to pay the bills. And so there's a lot of hand-wringing over what Treasury should do.
Even short of a default, hitting the debt ceiling would stop the government's ability to finance its operations, including providing for the national defense or funding entitlements such as Medicare or Social Security. The default could cause the loss of 3 million jobs, add $130,000 to the cost of an average 30-year mortgage, and raise interest rates enough to increase the national debt by $850 billion.
What does this do to U.S. credit rating? That one of the worst things that could happen would be for people to decide U.S. debt was less safe. And for that credit downgrading is really important because what it says is, you know, U.S. debt is not the very, 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 very safe and secure debt we once thought it was. So that means we're probably going to need a bigger return in order to be willing to hold U.S. debt.
Meanwhile, the recent turmoil in the banking industry of concerned investors. In early May, officials closed San Francisco-based First Republic Bank, making it the third U.S. bank to collapse in the past 2 months. Most of First Republic's assets are being acquired by J.P. Morgan, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank, whose clients were mostly from the tech industry, collapsed in March under similar circumstances. But they are not alone. The U.S. Federal Reserve has revealed that 722 banks reported unrealized losses exceeding 50% of their capital at the end of the third quarter of 2022. Those losses have occurred because banks bought lots of treasuries and bonds when interest rates were near zero. Now, as the Federal Reserve raises rates to combat inflation, the value of these bonds has declined. Unrealized losses on banks' books can weaken their ability to meet unexpected liquidity needs, leaving them with less cash on hand than anticipated.
Trillions of dollars of U.S. treasuries are held and traded every day. And the result by, you know, this empirical literature is that U.S. taxpayers pay about 25 basis points less in interest when we borrow money than other big countries. if we were to lose that advantage, and we were just to be thought of similarly, the lending to the U.S. government was thought similarly to lending, you know, in euros, lending in yen, that sort of thing, and we were to lose that 25 basis point advantage, that would cost us about $750 billion over the next decade.
And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The facial recognition surveillance system violates Palestinians' human rights to freedom of movement and privacy. The Zionist regime is deepening its system of apartheid in the occupied Palestinian territories by using artificial intelligence-powered biometric facial recognition technology to track and restrict the movements of Palestinian people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out wrote in this regard, facial recognition technology identifies and categorizes people on the basis of their physical features, including race, ethnicity, gender, age, and disability status. Facial recognition technology was first introduced into the Zionist regime apartheid in 1999. But a new report from Amnesty International has examined the use of a novel facial recognition technology system known as Red Wolf, which has been deployed at military checkpoints in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil since 2022. It scans the faces of Palestinians, often denies them entry, and adds them to massive Israeli regime databases without their consent. Facial recognition technology is increasingly being used to stalk Palestinians, keeping them under near-constant observation. The surveillance is accomplished with a network of closed-circuit television CCTV cameras mounted on lampposts, the sides of buildings, surveillance towers, and rooftops. The Zionist regime troops are given incentives to keep Palestinians under constant surveillance. In a shameful contest, the troops are awarded prizes for the battalion with the highest number of Palestinians registered into the database. The West Bank, including illegally annexed East Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, remain under illegal Zionist regime military occupation. The fabricated regime of Israel controls the ingress and egress of Palestinians, who must have permits from Israeli regime authorities to cross between Gaza, East Al-Quds, and the West Bank. Agnes Callamard, Amnesty International Secretary General, said the Israeli authorities are using sophisticated surveillance tools to supercharge segregation and automate apartheid against Palestinians, using illegitimately acquired biometric data to monitor and control Palestinians' movements. In addition to the constant threat of excessive physical force and arbitrary arrest, Palestinians must now contend with the risk of being tracked by an algorithm or barred from entering their own neighborhoods based on information stored in discriminatory surveillance databases. In a new 82-page report titled Automated Apartheid, How Facial Recognition Fragments, Segregates, and Controls Palestinians in the OPD, Amnesty International details Israeli regime's authorities' extensive use of facial recognition technology to support their continued domination and oppression of Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories. This report elaborates on Amnesty International's 2022 report, The Zionist Regime's Apartheid Against Palestinians, Cruel System of Domination and Crime Against Humanity, which found that the Zionist regime maintains a system of oppression and domination over Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories and the diaspora. The said segregation is conducted in a systematic and highly institutionalized manner through legislation and policies and practices that are intended to prevent Palestinians from enjoying equal rights to the Jewish Israelis. The new report cites Palestinian residents of Al-Khalil and occupied East Al-Quds, who describe the ways in which surveillance cameras invade their privacy, discourage activism, erode their social life, and leave them feeling constantly exposed, even in their homes. They have to cover their windows with black blinds to avoid exposure to the electric eyes. Sarah, who lives in the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Selvan, says, "When the cameras were set up, if we stood by the window, we could be detected as if the cameras were just in our house. With cameras watching our every move, we were put in a terrible position. We couldn't feel at home in our own house and had to be fully dressed all the time." Neda, a Palestinian resident, reported, "I'm being watched the whole time. It gives me a really bad feeling everywhere in the street. Every time I see a camera, I feel anxious, like you're always being treated as if you are a target." The Zionist regime authorities often aim the biometric surveillance at sites with cultural and political significance, such as the Damascus Gate entrance to the Old City, where Palestinians frequently meet and hold protests in support of prisoners on hunger strike and against repeated Israeli offensives in the occupied Gaza Strip. The number of CCTV cameras increased in the neighborhoods of Sheikh Jarrah and Silvan in East Al-Quds after 2021 protests against the forced evictions of Palestinian families to make way for Jewish settlers. In Selvan, the surveillance has increased as the number of settlers has risen. "These surveillance cameras are not there to make the place more secure," said Jawad Siam, director of Wadi Helve Information Center, which provides legal aid to children from Selvan who are arrested by Israeli regime forces for participating in protests, adding, "They are there to scare Palestinians and protect Zionist settlers. Everything is watched. My whole life is watched. I don't have any privacy," Isa Amro, a Palestinian activist in Al-Khalil, said, adding, "I feel they are following me everywhere I go." Amro reported that Palestinians are angry because facial recognition surveillance is not used to identify Israeli settlers who have committed crimes against Palestinians. Thank you. And that is because the Zionist regime is not using the facial recognition technology to protect Palestinians, but rather to shield Israelis in the illegal settlements that are built on the Palestinian land. Al-Khalil and East Al-Quds are the only two cities in the occupied Palestinian territories that have illegal Israeli settlements within their boundaries. In Al-Khalil, there are about 33,000 Palestinians and 850 settlers. Surveillance is part of a coercive environment aimed at forcing Palestinians to leave areas of strategic interest to Israeli authorities by making their ordinary lives unbearable, the report says. The report documents how this elaborate web of AI-driven surveillance violates international human rights and international humanitarian laws. Under the Fourth Geneva Convention, the Zionist regime, which is the occupying power, is prohibited from settling civilians in occupied territory, forcibly transferring the population, annexing territory, and carrying out collective punishments, punishing the population for crimes they didn't commit. In the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, inhuman acts committed in the context of an institutional regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another racial group with the intent to maintain that regime constitute apartheid. The Apartheid Convention defines apartheid as inhuman acts committed for the purpose of establishing and maintaining domination by one racial group of persons over any other racial group of persons and systematically oppressing them. Both the Rome Statute and the Apartheid Convention list apartheid as a crime against humanity. The biometric surveillance system, augmented by facial recognition technology, violates the rights to freedom of movement, privacy, equality, and non-discrimination. It has a chilling effect on the rights to freedom of expression and freedom of peaceful assembly by discouraging Palestinians from demonstrating and intensifying the climate of fear and intimidation. The report notes, because the settlers' presence in the occupied territories is illegal under the Geneva Convention, the security justification for the surveillance is also illegitimate. The deployment of remote biometric surveillance tools that restrict freedom of movement in the context of a prolonged military occupation, illegal settlement and annexation entrenches the segregation and fragmentation of the Palestinian people and ultimately helps maintain Palestinian and strengthen Israeli regime's cruel system of apartheid in the occupied Palestinian territories, the report states, adding these tools contribute to the commission of prohibited acts constituting the crime against humanity of apartheid as well as to war crimes.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In the previous edition of the program, we had a look at the different parts, different phrases of Kumail's supplication in details. In this edition, however, we will have a look at the general frame of supplication of Kumail. Dear listeners, in the previous episode, we mentioned that the prayer of supplication, the structure of the supplication of Kumail, consists of three stages. The first stage is like a preamble in the supplication, and it prepares the grounds for the supplicant to pray to Allah, to implore Him, the Exalted, and to stand before Him. In this first stage, which is like a preamble, in this introduction, Imam Ali alayhi salam begins with two requests. The first is forgiveness, and the second is his remembrance and thankfulness and proximity to Him. And we said that both of these things are necessary if the one is about to stand and intends to stand before Allah, to implore Him, to ask Him. The second section of this preamble involves the presentation of need and desire and raghbah toward Allah. And Imam Ali alayhi salam first says that there is no escape from Allah, and secondly, there is no refuge with other than the Almighty Allah. And in the third section of this preamble, Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions the misfortune and wretchedness of man. And this wretchedness is undoubtedly the outcome of man's own deeds. This is why Imam Ali alayhi salam calls for the Almighty Allah to forgive him his sins, because these sins act as impediment in the way of acceptance of supplications. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "So I ask you by your might not to let my evil deeds and acts veil my supplication from you, not to disgrace me because of the hidden things you have come to know from my innermost secret, not to hasten in punishing me for what I have done in privacy of my evil acts and wrongdoings." In the fourth section, Imam Ali alayhi salam emphasizes on a noble concept which we have mentioned, and that is man cannot find shelter during hardships and misfortune with other than his master. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "O Allah, who do I have other than you so that I may implore him to remove my affliction and to have regard for my affairs?" In another section of this first stage of supplication, Imam Ali alayhi salam makes two confessions. Confessions of wrongdoings and the confession that man has no argument against Allah in transgressing his boundaries, in violating his commands, and in following his lowly desires. Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah. Oh, zalamtu nafsi, ya Mawlai. Zalamtu nafsi.
واشتد على العزيمة جوانحي واشتد على العزيمة جوانحي.
In the sixth and actually the last section of the preamble, after one has confessed to his disobedience, sins and wretchedness, and after one has declared that there is no refuge from Allah but with Him, and after one has sought Allah not to punish him on account of his wrongdoings and offenses, And in one word, after displaying his humility and indigence before Allah, the Exalted, the servant declares that he has turned to his master in confession of his sins, regretting them, broken, apologizing out of knowledge that there is no refuge from his misfortune and hardships, except with Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Now I have come to you, O Allah, after my shortcomings and my immoderation toward myself. I am regretful, broken, apologizing, pleading for forgiveness, repenting, acknowledging, submissive, and confessing. I find no place to flee from what I have done, nor any place of escape to which I may turn in my affairs, other than your acceptance of my excuse, and your entering me into the compass of your mercy." With this phrase, this first stage of the structure of the supplication of Kumail, this preamble comes to an end. Servant is now prepared to stand before Allah to supplicate and entreat him. He has affirmed all this by the statement, "Now I have come to you, O Allah." So this preamble, this first and beginning part of the supplication of Kumail, which is rather long preamble, prepares the ground for the servant to be ready to talk to the Almighty Allah. This fact teaches us this important matter, that if we want to talk to someone like the Almighty Allah, if we want to be the one who deserves to stand before the Almighty Allah, first we have to prepare the grounds. We have to make confessions. We have to realize to whom we're talking to. And then we are ready to talk to him. Then, only then we are allowed to present our needs to him. First, we have to realize that we are needy. We have to realize our neediness, and then we have to present this neediness to him, to the one we are about to talk to. Now, in the second stage, this second stage is the one in which Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions those wasail and means by which he seeks recourse to the Almighty Allah. It seems that there are four different means mentioned in this second stage. The first means is the previous grace and mercy of the Almighty Allah. The second means is our love for him and our confession of his oneness and his unity, confession to monotheism. The third means is our weakness in resisting the punishment. And the fourth means is the seeking of refuge by a slave who has fled from his master and disobeyed him. We will, God willing, talk about each of them in details in the next episode. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
In the 2020 presidential election, former U.S. President Donald Trump was able to challenge President Joe Biden to a large extent in terms of economic indicators. In other words, the economy became the weak point of Biden and the Democrats. Now, there are signs that their continuation could make it difficult for Biden or any other Democratic Party candidate in the 2024 presidential election. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media for further details. Please stay with us to hear more about this story. The Financial Times reports the Federal Reserve warned that the latest banking turmoil could trigger a broad credit crunch that threatens to slow the U.S. economy, while central bank lenders said they plan to tighten lending standards amid concerns about loan losses and deposit flight. Two separate Fed releases on Monday, May 8, highlighted growing concerns that the collapses of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank in March and recent collapse of the First Republic will lead to a contraction in lending and push asset prices lower. The U.S. Federal Reserve said in its semi-annual financial stability report that despite decision action by regulators and officials to deal with recent regional banking crises, concerns about the economic outlook, credit quality, and funding liquidity could mean that banks and other financial institutions to further contract the supply of credit to the economy. The Fed added, a sharp decline in the availability of credit would raise the cost of financing for businesses and households, potentially leading to a slowdown in economic activity. The possibility of a credit crunch was cited as one of the top current risks to the financial system, rather than the Fed's most likely scenario. But it reflected concerns about the macroeconomic impact of one of the most turbulent months in American finance since 2008 global financial crisis. Fears of a credit crunch come as a potential U.S. debt default looms, while the White House and Congress are locked in an impasse over increasing the government's $31.4 trillion credit limit. As part of its stability report, the Fed surveyed market experts and academics. The stock, which ranks stress in the banking sector as top threat to stability, has quadrupled since the fall and is now on par with inflation and U.S.-China tensions. According to this survey, concerns about commercial and residential real estate are also increasing rapidly. The Fed also released the results of its quarterly opinion poll of senior loan officers on Monday, May 8, which showed banks expect to tighten lending standards for the remainder of 2023. Bank officials pointed to concerns about a recession and withdrawals from deposits following the collapse of the SVB. The Fed said in the survey, medium-sized compared to the largest banks with between $50 billion and $250 billion in assets, and other banks more frequently cited concerns about their liquidity positions, deposit outflows, and funding costs as reasons for tightening. In order to retain depositors, some banks have had to offer higher yields on savings accounts, which weighed on profit margins. Mid-sized banks, which faced the largest outflows of deposits, also feared tighter regulations and possible changes in accounting rules. Regarding how a possible credit crunch could spread more broadly, the Fed's financial stability report said there was a risk of falling profits and rising corporate defaults. It added furthermore, a related reduction in investor risk appetite could lead to a significant fall in asset prices. The Fed also warned of weakness in the commercial real estate sector, saying, "The magnitude of a correction in real estate values could be significant and therefore lead to credit losses for CRE debt holders." The central bank said it will also monitor developments in commercial real estate loans more closely and expand screening procedures for banks with a greater focus on this sector. Meanwhile, Agence France-Presse writes, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned of an emerging financial catastrophe, once again raising the alarm about the failure of lawmakers to timely approve the rising of the government's monumental debt ceiling. Yellen said on Sunday, May 7th, Congress's failure to act upon the debt ceiling could trigger a constitutional crisis that also would call into question the federal government's creditworthiness, calling on lawmakers from both dominant political parties to make sure that Congress does its job and readily approves the U.S. government's budget bill. She underlined, "It's Congress' job to do this." Reiterating, if they fail to do it, we will have an economic and financial catastrophe that will be of our own making. And there is no action that President Joe Biden and the U.S. Treasury can take to prevent that catastrophe. Yellen further on the line, "Our priority is to make sure that Congress does its job. There is no way to protect our financial system in our economy other in Congress doing its job and raising the debt ceiling and enabling us to pay our bills. This would be a constitutional crisis." Yellen had previously stressed that it was the basic responsibility of Congress to increase or suspend the whopping $31.4 trillion borrowing cap set for the government without delay. After the January due date had expired, the U.S. Treasury chief told lawmakers in February that the government will likely run out of money in June and most likely be unable to issue payments to its employees, the military's family, seniors, and others dependent on the government. However, Republican lawmakers have linked an increase to the government's debt ceiling to its slashing of public spending. Republican House Majority Leader Steve Scalise of Louisiana insisted in a recent interview that passage of debt ceiling would require Biden and other Democrats to change the entire dynamic of the process, thus putting pressure on them to better engage in negotiations with Republican lawmakers.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very interesting topic, a very important topic, and that topic is related to trade, and it specifically, it is about the etiquettes of trading. So today we want to ask the question, what are the etiquettes and the adab of trading and tijarat? As you know, trade and tijarat is a very important topic. It's actually a virtue. In the Holy Quran, we read, O you who have faith, do not eat up your wealth among yourselves unrightfully, but it should be traded by mutual consent. And do not kill yourselves. Indeed, Allah is most merciful to you. So commerce and trading is a virtue in Islam. But like all virtues, you know, it has its own etiquettes. It has its own norms and own, you know, obviously it has certain obligations and certain prohibitions. These are mentioned, have been mentioned in the, you know, in the subject of fiqh. You know, this program is not concerned directly with that subject. But there are other etiquettes and customs that should be followed when trading. So the answer to the question that we posed can be given in the form of a prophetic hadith. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has been narrated as having said, whoever sells or buys must avoid five habits, or he should not sell or buy at all. Right, so there's five customs or habits or etiquettes that a person who wants to buy or sell or do trade. And the Prophet was, by trade or by profession, he was a businessman. You know, as you know, in history tells us that, you know, he took the goods and wares of the Lady Khadija, right, to different places, and you know, he traded and he sold them for her. Right. So by profession, right, he was, you know, a businessman, and so this gives more weight to this hadith. The Prophet said that there are five habits that, you know, the person should observe if he wants to sell or buy. The first is usury, meaning he should avoid taking or giving usury. False oaths, he should not make a false oath when selling something or buying something. For example, like say he's selling his car, you want to sell your car to somebody, and you know that it doesn't work well, you shouldn't say, this works fine, I swear to you that it works okay, you know, just buy it from me. Or, you know, make a false oath that you're going to hand over the goods to this person when you don't really want to, or that you're going to pay him but you don't intend to do so. Another is hiding the defects of the merchandise, you know, hiding him so that the customer doesn't know about him. Also, praising what he sells. You shouldn't overly praise something that you want to sell when you know it's not true. And finally, the Prophet said, showing disapproval for what he intends to buy, you know, like kind of indicating the fact that you don't want it, but you don't like it, but you really intend to buy it. Maybe you're trying to get the person selling it to, you know, lower his price or something. And these are all etiquettes and customs of the person who wants to trade, meaning to buy or sell, in the words of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the etiquettes of trade, the etiquettes of buying and selling. And what are the etiquettes of buying and selling? Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT-5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.